This is August 18th, 2000, or 2000, if you prefer to say it that way, as I do sometimes. And I'm Calder Pickett, and I've been doing these interviews now off and on since 1989, and I've done a great many of them. And this is one I really look forward to, because it's with someone I still think of as a young lady that I first knew when we were on the University Centennial Committee back in, 66 or 67. And in fact, it was rather interesting. A number of years ago, when she was still Vice Chancellor, I called the office and I said, "I'd like to talk to Dean L. Reese." And the secretary said, "Who?" And I was really nonplussed, really. And then suddenly I remembered. And this was in the 70s or 80s, right? Yeah. Really. And because I guess that I still thought of you that way, as a bright, vivacious little college girl who was on that committee with me, and that's how we got to know each other. And I will want to talk with you in a while about your college days. Now, I would like you to start with some basic kinds of things. Tell us your date of birth, your place of birth, the names of your parents, what your dad did for a living, and so on, to get us started.
Okay, well, I was born in Goodland, Kansas on January 26, 1946. My grandparents lived in Canarado, and my mother had gone back because she was pregnant with me, and my dad was in the off the coast of Morocco during World War II on a Navy destroyer, and so mother was alone and went back to Sherman County. Her brother had just died the previous year. He was a pilot over England and died in a plane crash during the war. So she went home to live with her parents in Canarado. Just to diverge a little bit, my grandmother, her mother, was the surgical nurse for the elder Franklin Murphy when she was at the medical center, and used to babysit with young Frank Murphy, who ended up being, of course, the chancellor here. My grandfather, to the contrary, was a landman, rancher, banker, one of those kind of western Kansas cowboys, who had a ranch between Sherman County, between Goodland and Sharon Springs, and then ultimately ended up in Canarado. So I was born in Goodland. My dad got back by the time I was born, but just barely. He had graduated from the School of Business here. His name is H.W. Bill Reese, and my mother's name is Mary Nell Diet Reese. And her mother was Nell Diet, who was in the first nursing class from Bell Memorial. When he came back, he didn't know what he was going to do. He had worked as an efficiency expert for Better Homes and Gardens before he went off to be skipper of the destroyer and had never seen the ocean, is the story. So when he came back, it was just when they were beginning to look at paving roads and trying to get a highway system through the state of Kansas. So the post-war years were the years in which really all of the Midwest became so dependent on the automobile to get them from one place to the other, as opposed to trains. And so Dad and his father had been in the highway construction industry since right after the Model T Ford. And so he and his dad and his brother formed a construction company in Scandia, Kansas, where my dad grew up, and started building paved roads, and were among the pioneers, really. You can still today go across roads in Kansas where Dad will say, "We put the first pavement on here," or "built the first bridges."
Well, now, Scandia, I don't think I've been there. I've been through Canarado many times, and I've been Goodland, of course, many times, and the part of the state that a lot of people like to put down, you know, this is But I always kind of like it out that way. But Scandia, where is it?
Scandia is in the north central part of the state. If you went to Salina and went directly north to within 8 miles of the Nebraska line to Highway 36, go 9 miles west is where Scandia is. Right along Highway 36 west of Belleville. The closest real town is Concordia, which
so
is
so it's really, really central Kansas. We came down through not that way. We were up on Interstate 80 because the construction on 70 has been driving us crazy, and so we like going across Nebraska, and we came down from through the Red Cloud, Willa Cather's town,
yeah.
and got on the Highway 24. I was determined to stop in Cocker City and take a picture of the ball of twine. I'd never done that.
So I had
to have that for my collection. So actually, then you were brought up mainly in Scandia.
Yes, we moved for a very short while to Topeka before we moved back to Scandia, because Dad and his brother also thought they'd build houses, but that didn't last long. And I moved back to Scandia when I was about 4 years old, and grew up my entire young life there. Went to a very, very small high school where I like to say I was the top 10% of my class, because my memory is there were 11 people in my high school graduating
class.
It was that
small, huh?
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about your parents. They were college people, both of them.
Oh, yes. But Mother graduated from the journalism school, and Dad graduated from the business school. And that was, of course, right there during the war.
You know, most of the people I interview, their parents didn't even go to high school.
My parents were very unusual for the time from those small towns. But both of them had been to college, and both had degrees. And interestingly, Mother's parents both had degrees. But anyway, so we were in this small town where my dad ran a construction company, and he was out traveling lots while I was growing up because they were building roads and he was building a construction company. My mother became early involved in politics, not as an elected person, but she started working in the Republican Party as long ago as I can remember. And one of my first memories is, I always hesitate to say this, but people get quite a laugh, when I was in about fifth grade, I think, was when she was the campaign chairman for Bob Dole when he ran for the first time for the House of Representatives. And I was a doll for Dole at all of grocery stores and little places around the what was then, it wasn't as big a district as it now is. I guess it was the old first, but this is the new first. So we went all over that part of western Kansas campaigning for Bob Dole for his first election campaign. So my mother was always actively involved in politics, as well as the United Methodist Church. Both of my parents are very active in that, and mother was very active. My vision of my mother is that she was always the fire that lit underneath me, and never thought there was any boundary to what a woman could do, so it never crossed my mind that there were any limits.
Of course, you know, when you're in Kansas, I guess you become a Republican. I told Noel I was gonna. I said I'm gonna ask Danelle why she's a Republican. But
I was born one.
yeah. I've been tempted to drop a note to Sandy Prager and ask her why she is, because she sounds like a Democrat to me, and which is often the case.
Well, I always say Kansas Republicans. Of course, I don't do politics anymore, but I always say Kansas Republicans defy all the stereotypes. And I always thought, for example, Nancy Kassebaum and Bob Dole, to a fair amount, really were much more populist than they are sort of what I would call stereotypical national Republicans.
Yeah, of course, there's a rather extreme wing that's developing. My daughter lives over in Johnson County, and she was saying that Greg Musil should have been a Democrat, and she has a strong dislike for Phil Klein. And I think maybe I do too, but I don't know him personally. But I mean, did you have brothers and sisters?
I had three sisters. I was the oldest of four girls. We all of us went to KU. All of us pledged our mother's sorority. We're all very active in our school and our church and our various things. In a small town, as you know, Calder, in a small town, you don't just do one or two activities. You do them all. You're the cheerleader, you're in the band, you're in the plays. And I've always thought that was a tremendous asset for me. Because I wasn't afraid to try anything.
Tell me about your home. Now, obviously, from what you've said, it would be different from a lot of homes that I've heard about. But did you have a lot of books and newspapers and radio and television?
Oh yeah. Well, we never had television. I never had television the whole time I was growing up. My mother, even after it was very popular, my mother refused to have a television
really?
In the house. So I didn't grow up with any television. We had a radio, though I wasn't really interested in sports at the time, so I didn't listen to the radio either. We did have lots of books. I had a great aunt who was a PhD in history, who had taught at William & Mary and then during the Depression came back to Kansas to the family farm in Harvey County. And I spent a lot of my summers with her. And she was quite a Charles Dickens scholar. And English history scholar. And I remember very distinctly the summer after my seventh grade, she made me read every single work of Charles Dickens.
Well, that's a good one to read.
Oh, it was wonderful, and I'm still a huge fan. So that whole tradition was very strong in our family. My parents also, now I reflect on it with my own kids, they made me read the newspaper every day. And our dinner table conversations would almost invariably include some current events.
Did you take the Salina Journal or what?
We took the Salina Journal and the Topeka Daily Capital.
Well, you read someone else that I used to bug him and say, Whitley, why are you a Republican? And he would just grunt. Because he and I agreed on almost everything, and he knew I was a Democrat.
And the Austins were very good friends of our family, and my sister, my sister's first husband, was a brother of Dan Austin's wife, Gail Davenport.
Oh, really?
So we have been good friends for a long time.
Yeah, well, I still have a lot of contact with Dan.
Right, I do too, actually.
Yeah.
Once in a while I hear from him, or I drop him a line on something I've read.
He was kind of a spoiled kid, but he's turned into
a great
human being.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
And I think the world of him.
I might add to that question, we also had, apropos of your comment about music, had music in our house all the time, and all of us took piano lessons. I played the organ for all 4 years that I was in high school at my little local Methodist church. I used to get up at 5 in the morning. Now I think about that and I can't believe I did it, but I'd get up at 5 in the morning and practice for 2 hours before I went to school. And so I just always have played the piano and organ.
When our daughter lived in Parsons, she was working for Clyde Reed down there, and she played the organ in two different churches. And she organized theater in the town.
Oh, bless her
heart. They put on several plays while she was down there and so on. Well, partly because if you don't do something like that in some towns, it can be a pretty static life. And she wanted to get involved in things. Now, you went to grade school there in Scandia.
I did, and high school. And one of my predominant memories of that is that we had just moved into a new school in November. It would have been about the 1st of November in 1963. And we were preparing for the first event in the auditorium in that new high school when word of Kennedy's assassination came. And I remember it because it was the afternoon of whatever this big, it was like the dedication of the school or something. And so everyone always remembers, but for me it's forever connected with my high school.
That was a very vivid day. Did you have teachers who, as you think back on them, motivated you, gave you, helped to shape you to become what you are?
Oh, yes, there's no question. The litany is actually long. I had excellent teachers. Even though it was a very small high school, they were dedicated, and there were several things that that I remember vividly. When I was in third, fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh grades, there was a teacher in a, it was a multi-grade grade school because there weren't enough kids for single grades, who stayed with me every day after school for at least an hour, and my memory is even more than that, and we spelled through the dictionary many times, and I was always in the state spelling contest, and Hilton Hodges got to where he knew me well. I went out the next to the last on onomatopoeia my seventh grade year.
You still a good speller?
Oh, yes. I'm better than spell check.
I'd like to challenge you.
Okay.
When I was in the fifth grade, a couple of us went down to the junior high. We had triumphed over everybody in the fifth and sixth grades, and we went down to the junior high, and a big, long spelling match, but these two eighth graders finally put me down. They got out the 100 spelling demons for adults, one of the kids on the Kansan used to say that I could walk past the Kansan newsroom and look through the window and see a misspelled word on somebody's paper, and that was almost the case. You know, I would go in there and change their spelling and fix up their semicolons and all their grammar and so on.
The other thing I valued, I also had two at least English teachers who made us diagram sentences.
Another of my passions.
And I love diagramming. And I make my law clerks once in a while diagram sentences because I don't think we understand the structure of sentences as well anymore.
Well, that's how, you know, when I taught reporting, I used to go to the blackboard and show them, especially with speech stories, how you should put a speech story lead together, and I would show them that, and they didn't know anything about parts of speech, but this was one of my passions. I took a whole class when I was in college.
Oh yeah.
College grammar. That's all we did was diagram sentences, and I loved it. Now you then went clear through school there in. When did you graduate from high school?
I graduated from high school in 1964, May of 1964.
64, okay. Did you graduate with honors? Or
oh yeah, I was valedictorian of my class. But as I say,
because I'm not surprised to hear that. But
I did well. But I had some classmates who were very competitive with me, and so it wasn't as if I was the only one. There were several people who did really pretty well. Very few of them went on to college. One of my other friends, actually a couple did for a while, but one other, I think, in my class graduated from college eventually.
You know, virtually all of my high school friends went to college.
Really? See.
Just from a little town out in Idaho, yeah.
Yeah.
What did you like in high school?
I loved everything.
Well, now, what did you like that would have meant that sometime you were going to go into law school?
Oh, I suppose now as I reflect, I suppose I loved world history. I loved American government. I'll tell you what I loved the most, though, and if I thought I could have made a living at it, I'd have done it. I won the state one-act play festival several times. I did all kinds of drama work. In fact, one of my one-act play partners came in to visit yesterday. He lives in Topeka. When we were reminiscing about that, if I could have done it, and still as I look back, I would have gone to the theater.
Yeah, past 2 weeks I've interviewed Bob Findlay and Ron Willis, and boy, have we gone through all the plays. I think Ron was rather interesting to realize that I had heard about most of the plays he was talking about.
Oh, I think
yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
1964. Well, that was a pretty important year. My gosh, yeah, that's the year of the Johnson-Goldwater campaign, and we were still feeling the effects of the Kennedy assassination. You came right to KU?
I came right to KU all my life. I thought I wanted to go to KU. We jokingly say my dad told us we could go anywhere, but he'd help pay our way to KU.
Well, you were in K-State country, though.
Oh, we still are. I mean, my hometown is K-State country. But my parents were both KU graduates, my grandparents. So there was never any question. The other people that my parents always, all through school, we came to KU for KU football games. We saw many of Wilt Chamberlain's basketball games. They made sure that we didn't feel uncomfortable at all on the KU campus. Now, I will say that I thought I was going east to college when I came to KU. From my little town, going to KU was just unheard of. There had virtually been no one come to KU other than my own family.
Did you ever give any thought to going to one of the girls' schools in the east or something
like
that? I
did. In fact, I applied to Bryn Mawr and got in. But there were probably two factors. One was I didn't have sense enough to know that there might be advantages to going to those that I might not have here. The other was that it was just so expensive. And
yeah.
At the time,
yeah.
My dad was a struggling contractor. So I felt very lucky to be coming to KU.
Now, did you ever have to get out and work yourself?
Oh, yes. I worked all through high school. I was a janitor in my granddad's office. Then I worked at my dad's office all the way through. I was a waitress for a while. I worked up here. But mostly I did student affairs work. I did worked at previews, worked as counselor, worked as things like that. And I worked in college, in law school. I was a resident director in a huge dorm when I went to law school. So.
Yeah. Well, I think that's good. I don't know. Both of our girls worked all the while they were in school. They didn't have to. But it was just something that we all understood, was that they would get jobs, you know. When you don't go into a sorority right off when you, what is it, second semester or something?
At that time, it was, I think, second semester. And my story is a very interesting one there, because my mother had been a very active sorority person and she felt very close to her sorority. I happened to be in a freshman class here with some just outstanding women. And it was the only year that Caruth O'Leary, my freshman year, was the only year that Caruth O'Leary was a freshman women's hall. And though she will deny it to the end of her time, Emily Taylor, I am absolutely sure, handpicked the people that went into Caruth O'Leary, because it was small. All of my friends ended up being all of the people who just excelled. And we had an incredible experience. I lived next door to Sarah Paretsky. I lived within two or three doors of Nancy Gallo. Cindy Harden was on my floor. I could go through, but you could simply list all these people that were just really very bright, very active, the kinds of women that Emily was interested in making sure they did well at KU. And so I ended up with the most fabulous group of friends. Now, but there is a very interesting story about that group. During Rush, almost all of us, now not quite, Sarah didn't go through Rush. Actually, Sarah ended up, I think, in a scholarship hall, as I recall.
Sarah would have probably run into trouble in some sorority.
Well, I don't know, but I loved her. I still love her.
I mean, I don't know whether those... I know that my college fraternity definitely would not have had Jews.
Oh, well, I hadn't even thought of that, but Sarah was, even at that time, such a brilliant mind, and there was a woman named Martha Quaid. Anyway, those of us who went through Rush that were in that group ended up really doing very well in Rush, and on the last night, I can remember exactly, I mean, I could see it as if it were yesterday. We gathered in that old women's restroom in Strong Hall when we had to fill out our preference cards. And we decided it would not be smart for all of us to try to do the same thing, that we would be a lot better off scattering out. And we did, and we each pledged different houses. Cindy Harden pledged Pi Phi. Nancy Gallup pledged Theta. I pledged Gamma Phi. There was a Chi Omega among the group, who I can't remember. anyway, we literally spread out. And it turned out to be wonderful, because then we ended up in the various offices and things in Panhellenic and our houses. And my view is it probably helped the whole hill at the time.
Did you like sorority life?
I loved it. A lot of the women weren't like me. 64 to 68 was just an amazing watershed time around KU. I might just say, when I came in, of course, there were closing hours, there were the things, the standards boards, all of those things. By my senior year, the seniors finally had keys to their houses. And we were beginning to question the fairness of the standards board arrangement. And then, of course, the 3 years after that, after I left, KU was sort of the cauldron in which many of these issues boiled.
Did the sororities go through all of that controversial upheaval? I was the faculty advisor for SAE.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah, and I finally got fed up with it, and I remember having a lunch with the advisor of the Betas and Sigma Chi. They were all having the same problem. There was drinking, drugs, playing cards all night, and wanting to get out of the house in the senior year into an apartment.
Mm-hmm.
The seniors all wanted to get out, and I'd get up in meeting and plead with them, but I got nowhere. I finally was glad to get out of that.
You know, I think most of that happened after I left. I certainly know it's true now. My son was a Beta. And I certainly know it's true now. At that time, nobody could live outside the sorority houses. So that just wasn't an issue. And in fact, you really look down your nose at people who did. But see, that was 68 was my last year. And I think a lot of that happened later. Now, my memory, drinking, yes, there have always been lots of good beer drinkers at KU. I don't remember much, it might have been my naivety, but I don't remember much hard liquor drinking that I know is the case now. I don't remember drugs at all. Now, that might have been that I was outside the loop. But I also think it was a little before that hit as hard as it eventually hit.
Were you one of the officers?
I was president of my house, yes.
Did you ever have any feeling because of the attitudes that were growing on the campus that maybe I shouldn't be in a sorority? Nola was a Chi Omega, but we could not get either of our girls to go through the Rush, and Carolyn became a little sister of Minerva, and she hated it. She just dropped right out because she didn't feel comfortable with the sorority girls.
I never got to that point. I think it's fair to say I've always felt a little different from a lot of the people that I was around, but I never felt uncomfortable. So when some things would happen, like petty reasons for not pledging somebody, or I did begin to question the standards boards, and I did begin to wonder about the fairness of that, of a living group making some judgmental decisions that they may or may not understand. Now, in retrospect, there were probably some things good about that, but I never felt uncomfortable. I now feel there was some exclusiveness. I wasn't as aware, I think, at the time. Some exclusiveness and some less than merits reasons for not letting people in or for taking this action or that action. But by and large, I it sounds naive, I thought the women in my house were pretty fair. Now, my daughter is at a school where there are Greek houses, and she didn't go through Rush either. It would not have been right for her. I'm not sure now, in my adult knowledge, whether I could be involved in I don't think I could be involved in a process like that. But I found it a wonderful place to live.
Well, being in a fraternity shaped me. I think it was a very important thing for me. We were awfully democratic, and we rushed very much out of the so-called independent ranks, and that's how we got some of our best guys.
Mm-hmm.
And what bothered me as I talked to some of the fraternity and sorority people on this campus is that they didn't think that way. They didn't, you know, if a guy's an independent, he's an independent now, and that's where he is going to be. How did you happen to be the student on the Centennial Committee?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. I got appointed to it, and I suppose, was Wesco the chancellor? I suppose Clark Wesco.
Yeah, probably. Wesco was still, he was still
the chancellor.
Yeah, he was still the chancellor.
Well, I would guess that that's probably how I got appointed. I was a mortarboard. I was president of my house. I was active in student government. I'd had a lot of experience across the campus and also worked for student affairs. So I assume that he appointed me, but I do remember that experience, and I remember many anecdotes about it, but the one I remember the best, which you may or may not remember, is that each member of the committee had the duty of introducing one of our major speakers, and I was given Jules Pfeiffer. And I, for a young woman from Scandia, Kansas, who never had looked at the Village Voice, but sort of knew who Jules Pfeiffer was, I decided I'd start subscribing to the Village Voice long before this speech was to occur, so that I would have some sense. Well, of course, this is in 66, I think. And New York was a bit ahead of where we were in Kansas in terms of the turmoil and sort of looking toward what was going to become the Vietnam era conflict and everything. And so I began to subscribe to the Village Voice, and it came into my mailbox at the sorority house, and I read it assiduously every time it came. So that by the time I introduced Jules Pfeiffer, I knew so much more about the milieu in which he was working, and I think it was a life-changing experience. Because through his sardonic, sarcastic, wonderful comedy, but great social critique, I began to look around me a lot more than I think I had prior to that time. So for me, that experience, to say nothing of all the other speakers that were just, we, as you remember, had dinners with them and things like that.
Yeah, that was a fine experience. I can't remember who most people were.
Arthur Clarke.
Well, remember. George Anderson was the chairman, wasn't he?
Yes, it was George Anderson, and you and I think Bill Conboy was on it.
Were there any other students?
One other man who I don't remember who it was.
No, I don't remember. Well, you came through loud and strong on that committee, and that's how I got to know you. Now you were in the college.
Yes.
You went into American Studies?
I did, and I started to say there were a couple of very important influences on me. One was, of course, George Wagner, who I recall going in to see very early when I came to KU. But I, by the luck of the draw, in what I think was his first year here, got Norm Yetman for an advisor. And, of course, at that time I thought he was a very senior faculty member. Now that I've returned and realized he probably came the same year I did, or roughly the same year. But he opened in me some horizons that I never thought about, and he wasn't afraid to absolutely challenge me to keep working, keep thinking, keep going to different levels. There were several others. I took courses from Eldon Fields in American Government. In American politics, that I'll never forget.
Yeah,
I took Stitt Robinson's Cultural and Intellectual History, and Cliff Griffin, Cultural and Intellectual History.
You may have been in the whole same class with me.
Huh? I don't know.
No, I was probably in it. I was picking up credits for that I could use. Oh, Lord, that was a decade before, didn't it? What's the matter with me?
Well, I loved those cultural and intellectual history classes. And a funny story on me that I don't know if Stitt Robinson remembers or not was at the first exam of my freshman year, I flunked it. It was the first time I'd ever even gotten anything lower than a B. And I called home, told my mother I was never going to make it in college, told her I was flunking out, I had to leave, crying my eyes out. And of course, my mother said, you aren't leaving, and you are going to study, and you just didn't know how to take the test, and you knew the material, I feel confident. So she said, you go in and see that professor. So I did, because I had to stay. My parents were going to let me throw that tuition money down the drain. I went in to see Stitt. He was so helpful. Well, I ended up getting an A in the course.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was part of that program. But I finally parted company with them, and
American Studies.
American
really?
Studies.
Really?
Well, yeah, I taught the graduate seminar.
Oh, I didn't know.
Yeah,
that.
I taught that for several years, but they shifted too much away from what I thought were the basic things. Now, when they dropped American literature and American history as requirements, I had a feeling that it was becoming an adjunct to the sociology department.
I think there was a great deal of worry about that during a period.
And I dropped out. There was a time I was teaching not only that, but Western Civ on top of my 12 hours in journalism.
Oh,
what I was teaching. I loved the American Studies, but you see, that was my my degree from Minnesota, and I guess I thought that the program here should be more like the one from Minnesota. And Jeff Steer and I have talked about this. Jeff understands, understood how I felt about that. I don't know how about Stuart. Stuart and I, Levine, he and I, we...
I don't know either. Norm, I know, is still active, and David Katzman, and...
Yeah. But anyway, that was a good place to be. And you graduated in 68 now. What did you do next?
Well, I went to law school, but I need to back up a little bit, because even in 1968, I think it's fair to say that the women around me, mostly, particularly in my house and that I knew the best, really weren't going on to any kind of postgraduate education. And indeed, I had a very serious pin mate at the time. And it got, in those days, you could take the LSAT and the MedCats and everything still in your senior year and get into places. Now that's no longer true. You have to take them earlier. Well, without telling my pin mate or my parents or anyone who knew me, I took the GRE, the MedCat, and the LSAT late in the first semester of my senior year. Saved my pennies and took all three tests. Why, I don't know, because my pin mate was no doubt convinced I was going to Johnson County and going to get married and do all those things. For some reason, for me, that just didn't feel quite right. And so I did far better on the LSAT than I did on the MedCat. Well, I did pretty well on the GRE, but far better on the LSAT. And so I'd never even known a woman lawyer. I'd never even met a woman. So I went to see Charlie Oldfather and Jim Logan and Paul Wilson. And I'd known them in various ways around the campus. And all three of them, not a one of them blinked when I said, I'm thinking about going to law school. Every one of them not only encouraged me, said, I'll help you, whatever you want to do, it's a great decision. Norm Yetman said, it's a great decision. It's what you want to do. I still haven't told my parents this, of course, or my family. So I start applying to law schools, and again, taking money out of my allowance so nobody will know I'm doing this, and got in everywhere I applied to a lot of the great law schools in the nation. And so then came the day of reckoning, and I can remember it so well. I got in to several private schools and to the University of Michigan. And so I finally get up my courage, and on a Sunday night in March, I called my father and I said, Dad, I think I'm going to go to law school. And there was this quiet at the end of the line, and he said, oh, that's very interesting. And then he kind of hung up. And I thought, well, now that was easier than I thought. Well, exactly 6 hours later, in the middle of the night, my house mother comes up and wakes me up, and she says, "Your father's at the door." He had gotten in the car from where he lived, driven to Lawrence, took me out for breakfast at what was the old Holiday Inn down there south, and for several hours tried to talk me out of this crazy decision.
What did he want you to do?
I don't know, but for to his credit, for all the right reasons, looking around him, he said to me, and it was a quote, he said, "Why, when you could do anything in the world, would you pick a profession where you can't succeed?" and it was because in 1968, in the state of Kansas, or really in the legal profession, there were a handful of women, not many at all. Now, I've been interested in Al Gore's mother, Pauline, because she obviously went to law school long before there were any women. And in later years, I've come to know some of the real pioneers. But at that time,
it wasn't happening in the 60s.
Oh no! In fact, even when then, there's the rest of the story. After he saw he couldn't talk me out of going to law school, he said, "Well, at least you're going to KU, aren't you?" And I gritted my teeth and I said, "Dad, I've talked to a lot of people and I've gotten in a lot of places. And I've been told it would probably be wise for me to go somewhere different from where I did my undergraduate work and get some new experiences. And I'm in some of the best law schools in the country. So I need to give myself a chance." Well, he fought that for a while. Then finally he said, "Okay," he said, "but if you're going to go to law school away, you have to go to a state university." So I said, "Okay,
yeah.
I'll go to the University of Michigan."
Yeah.
And that's how I decided where to go to law school.
Before I get you to Michigan, I want to drop back to one other little thing. How did you respond to the student protest movements?
Well, you
were... Were you ever in them?
Yes, and I'll tell you, but it was when I was at Michigan, not here. You see, in 1968...
That's right. It would have... The bigger ones actually did come later.
Later. Martin Luther King was assassinated in April of my senior year. Even the height of the Vietnam conflict didn't come till slightly later than that. And certainly the student protests didn't occur till later. But I'll tell you what did happen to me, and it happened at Michigan. I was never a part of what happened at KU, though there is a story about what I used it for. But then I went to Michigan, and just like I had been here, I got very active. And in my sophomore year, which would have been, the fall of 69, I had been appointed to the Student Admissions Committee to the Faculty Admissions Committee as the student representative on the Law School Admissions Committee for the University of Michigan Law School. Now, I need to remind you that all across the country, the Black African movement was making a demand, out of which actually some of the big Supreme Court cases, for a 10% quota of minority admissions in the professional schools. They had made that demand at Michigan. And there were only two students on the admissions committee. You may also remember that the University of Michigan closed down for 3 days, I think it was. There was bombing. There was the law school. There was this beautiful Gothic quadrangle with these gorgeous stained glass windows. And etched in my memory is the day that we had to go to, one of the days the university was closed and there were no lights and it was like a battleground. The other person on the admissions committee was a Black woman from Georgia, other student. I caught the lines of the halls of the law school were lined with protesting students. And it was not really safe. They had cherry bombs and all kinds of things. But there was an admissions committee meeting up on the third floor to make a decision about this 10% quota business. And I called my friend, the other student on the committee, and I said, "I can go to this because I can walk through those halls and they will recognize that I will go to it because I have a white face. But don't go." And I will, because it was so dangerous for her to walk through those protesters and go to that admissions committee. I will never forget her words, and I have forgotten her name. But her words were, if I ever stood for anything, I will go to this meeting. So she and I met about a block away from the law school and walked through those halls together, and I can still feel how scared I was. And people threw things at you. They knocked your books out of your hand. And there were no lights, so it was dark. It was a very frightening experience.
That was Michigan and Wisconsin were two of the stormiest places. I mean, I had colleagues, friends at both of those places, and they almost aged in those. Mm. Of course, we had got bad enough here.
Absolutely. Now, I will tell you, for my senior thesis, I thought I was going back into higher education administration, which, of course, I did for a while. And I wrote my senior honors thesis at the law school on due process at the University of Kansas during those years, and did a whole paper on the judicial, there was this, they call it student judiciary. Anyway, Martin Dickinson was involved in it. There were a lot of people involved in it who heard the hearings from those days. And so I did a whole paper on it and got all the original materials. I still have a lot of that material. What they call it? Judicial counsel, that's what they call it. So I did my senior honors thesis on how KU dealt with those years.
At Michigan, who were the people there? Who were the professors? Okay, I'm just curious about what your experience there was in terms of the faculty that you had and the influences that might have marked you at that time.
The faculty there were several that marked me considerably with whom I worked. They are names mostly known in the law and not probably known as broadly, but a guy named Yale Kamathar was my criminal law professor. He is the one that at least is credited with bringing the whole Miranda warning into the jurisprudence of the United States. He was so upset by police tactics that he had observed in some police departments that he was very much involved in the original Supreme Court decision on Miranda. And then, of course, in the one in this last term, was one of the debaters on the side of keeping Miranda, which ultimately prevailed in the Supreme Court. A fellow named Theodore St. Antoine was the dean. He was quite a labor lawyer and a great gentleman, but also a very fair person. And I credited him a lot with how those very turbulent times were negotiated, and I watched him very carefully in his administrative style, because he was a labor negotiator. And he knew how to do that, and it served him in very good stead in higher education administration. There were two people, whose names I'm going to totally blank, the president of the university I knew, and also there was a person who was essentially the provost who was on the law school faculty. And I did a lot of work with him because I was so interested in higher education administration. And so it turned out to be a great place, but my flip way of describing what happened to me was I went from being Miss Pillsbury Bake-Off to being very close to one of the radicals of those periods, because your eyes just got opened by some of the consciousness that got raised as you thought about it. Now, I never was part, really, of the protest. I've always been a sort of orderly change from the inside type person. But I learned a great deal. The other thing I never was, there were a lot of feminist activities and really very radical people on the campus at the time. I never was really terribly involved in any of that, though I gladly would call myself a feminist, yeah. But never was involved. I was too busy.
Where did you live?
In a
dormitory or something?
My first year I lived in an apartment with some other women. And after that I was a resident director in South Quadrangle, which anyone who's ever been near the University of Michigan knows. It's an enormous residence hall, which at that time the university for some reason thought it was smart to put Bo Schembechler's football team and the freshman women in the same dorm with steel doors in between them.
Mm-hmm.
And frequently the steel doors were knocked down. And Michigan has, though it is a great national university, it has many of the same elements that other state universities have. many young people who come from, say, the Upper Peninsula or more rural areas.
Mm-hmm.
And so for them, coming into this giant state university, which is very sophisticated in a way and quite radical at the time, was a terrible shock. So I remember trying to work with these freshman women who had come in, and of course my experience at KU was invaluable to me, and at the same time sort of working on all of these people who were having appropriate hearing processes and things for various kinds of protests, having these athletes who, though they were very good football players, paid little attention to anybody else's rights. So my job there was to design a judicial council system for them. I designed it, and I assume some parts of it may still persist, but it was during the earliest days of my even understanding procedural due process in legal terms.
Well, tell me something. Did you ever have any fun? Did you ever go out socially?
Oh, yes.
I haven't quite got that feeling of from.
Oh yes, if you talk. In fact, I would have to say that I probably was less social at KU than I was at Michigan. At KU, I don't know. I suppose people might today call me a nerd.
Did you have a boyfriend when you were here?
Oh yes. I was pinned to a fellow in a fraternity, not who I ultimately married, but. That kind of came to an end with my KU career. But and then I had many friends, male and female, and one very steady male friend in law school. But I played a lot at Michigan. In fact, I probably didn't study as much as I should have studied at
Michigan.
Well,
it's probably just as well. You only live once.
That's right, and I had a great time in law school, and it was, in a way, the place where the world opened up for me.
Yeah.
And I met people from all over the world, literally.
Now, how long are you in law school to get a degree?
3 years.
3 years?
Yes, I was there for 3 years.
Is the degree that you get considered the equivalent of a PhD?
My friends in philosophy would say that it's not equivalent. It's more like a professional doctorate, but you don't have to do the dissertation.
No, you didn't have that.
No, but you do 3 years of classwork, and most people, or a lot of people, did a major senior writing project, third year writing project, which I did, which was on those judicial systems here, and so. This was the debate that we frequently had when I was in the Vice Chancellor's office, which doctorates are valued more or less here.
Yeah, well, I think I know which you are and which you're not.
I always felt somewhat honored to be at least thought to be competitive to be Vice Chancellor, because there are those who would say that a law degree is what it is, a professional degree.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that that is so bad. Especially as I see some of the people I've come to know over the years in the exotic disciplines of the college. I don't know.
Well, I respect them, but it's called a Juris Doctor. Actually, for many years in this, I just wrote a foreword to a book for gathering Paul Wilson's writings, and he refused. The law schools used to give what is called an LLB, which was Bachelor's of Law, and then at some point right about when I came through, they changed to a JD, but Paul Wilson refused to change his. He thought it was better for it to be an LLB.
Yeah. Let's see now, if you went there in 68, then you finished in 71, was there an upheaval at Michigan because of Kent State?
Yes, there was, but I'll tell you, it almost blended in because there was such upheaval over almost everything all the time. Mm. Obviously, Kent State was it. Now, I don't remember exactly when that happened.
70.
Yeah.
It was the spring of 70.
Yeah, and I do remember that, and it was terribly volatile at Michigan at the time. But it did sort of blend in with all the other kinds of things that were occurring on the campus. But it was of course just jarring for everybody. Although I'll tell you, it didn't seem terribly unrealistic to people at Michigan, because the atmosphere there had been so sort of charged that the fact that might happen somewhere was not terribly surprising.
Well, the biggest shock that a lot of us had about Kent State was it as though it had happened at Kansas State.
Yeah.
Where things were not happening.
Yeah.
I knew faculty people at Kansas State who were almost wistful, wishing that we could send some of our rabble-rousers down there so they could have a little excitement on the campus. I remember we went to a football game down there, and right after Nixon had come there to give a talk, and the kids from KU got up where they had this great big banner, and they started to walk around the track. It said, K-State is Nixon's favorite high school. And man, did those KU kids get mobbed, you know.
It was funny.
We were down there with the Brinkmans, and oh man, you know, that was really something when that happened. Now, 1971, is that when you came back here?
No, I came to the end of my law school time, or in the spring, and I had job offers. I was considering going to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, because the fellow I had dated in law school was from Pittsburgh, and I had an offer from a big law firm there. I had a couple of offers in Kansas City. And I just couldn't quite decide what I wanted to do, and I went in to see a guy named Terry Sandelow, who is on the faculty at the law school there. And he gave me an application. He said, "Danelle, I think you ought to apply for the White House Fellows Program. I think you'd be a perfect candidate." And I'd never heard about it, didn't know anything about it. I applied and looked at the list of people, and for one, there'd been very few women in the program, and for two, there had been no Kansans and no perceptible Midwesterners. But I applied, and I got through the first. It's a competition much like the Rhodes, and got through the first interviews, got through the second interviews, and went to the national interviews right the day of my law school graduation. So I missed my law school graduation to go to these. You went out to Airlie House, which is an estate outside Washington, and were interviewed by this incredibly high-powered team of commissioners. At that time, General Earl Wheeler was on it. Tex Thornton, who was chairman of the Board of Litton Industries, the guy who owned the Cincinnati paper and the Cincinnati Reds. Anyway, people like that, Mercedes Bates, there were just these incredible people. Well, and Milton Friedman, and they were these rigorous three-day interviews, one-on-one with these panel members. I think I got saved and got picked because I was so tired. I'd had to close out that freshman hall, stayed up all night, taken two exams early, done everything I had to do to get out of Ann Arbor, shipped my stuff home with my parents, flew to Washington, hadn't had any sleep for about 3 days. So in between every one of my interviews, instead of stewing and worrying, I just went to sleep. I was selected. And there were, I think, about 15 people in my class. Among them were Henry Cisneros, Bud McFarlane. I don't know if you knew of John Grinnells, who was quite a decorated Marine. A guy who's gone on to be the CEO of a giant company. I mean, 15 of us like that. And there were two of us that were women. I was the first Kansan ever. And I think it was the seventh woman in history in the program. So then I went to Washington. And in the White House Fellows Program, you get assigned to a cabinet officer, and there's an education program along with it. Well, you have this sort of meet and match through the summer with the cabinet officers, try to decide to whom you'll be assigned. And my last two choices, sort of there but for the grace of God, were I could choose between John Dean, the White House Counsel's Office, or the Secretary of Labor, who was James Hudson. And I chose the Secretary of Labor, because I decided I wanted to see an old line agency.
That way you stayed out of Watergate.
And I stayed out of whatever troubles there might have been awaiting me. And so I had a wonderful year, because at that time George Shultz was very close to the Labor Department. There was a guy named Mike Mosco, who was just a wonderful economic mind. Jim was secretary. Larry Silberman, who is now my colleague on the D.C. Circuit, was the undersecretary. I got to know Bill Essery. I don't know if that name will mean anything. He was head of the National Negotiation Conciliation Service for a long, long time, and when it probably still today would be said to be the best labor negotiator in the country.
What did you get paid?
Oh my. I don't remember.
Enough to keep going?
Oh yes. They paid us. I was like an administrative assistant.
Well, now, where did they house you?
You had to find your own, and I lived with, actually one of the women that I'd lived with in law school, we had a townhouse up in Northwest. And then the education program, which all the fellows do together, is you meet almost every leader in almost every aspect of not only American but international life, all the leaders in business, all the leaders in the military, all the sort of international people. We've met many heads of state. We went to Ethiopia, well, and also Henry Kissinger was head of the National Security Council. And it was right before Nixon's trip to China. And so we went to the Far East and were...
You did?
Oh, right before Nixon's trip to China, we did a lot of... Now, I don't want to overstate what we did, but we did a lot of background work, and some, I think, is still classified, prior to Nixon's trip to China. And we went to Korea, Hong Kong, Singapore, Thailand, Vietnam. I was in Vietnam. I went to the DMZ in the fall of 1971 at the height of the Vietnam conflict. We were entertained by President Chu. We had several briefings all over Southeast Asia. It was an incredible experience. Mm-hmm. We were meeting with military people, business people, both domestic American business and our partners. The real issue at that time was, of course, the allies around Asia were worried about what might have to be traded off for Nixon to go into China. And so we did a lot of sort of, I would say, diplomatic work in our ally states around the sort of border on China. And it was fabulous. And we had a private meeting with the Pope on our way home on Christmas Eve. It was amazing. We went totally around the world. I went from Scandia, Kansas on Thanksgiving. I flew with the local undertaker and a body to Denver. Got on a plane, met the rest of the White House fellows in, I think, Seattle. Got on a plane, go all over Southeast Asia, and because of the time frame from Rome to Kansas, I was back home at Christmas night.
I've never been to that part of the world, and probably I'm not likely to go there. How about Washington? Did you avail yourself of all of the opportunities?
Absolutely there? Everything. I loved it, and
it's a wonderful city, isn't it?
Yes, and you know, I saw it from the most incredible vantage point, because here I am working at cabinet level, in and out of the White House all the time. Got invited to, like, we went to the White House fellows are a very natural group to get invited to some of these things where you need some younger folk around. And we went to the White House Christmas party, and we went to the Easter egg roll.
Well, you met Nixon.
What did
you think of Nixon?
I thought Nixon, let me say first, I have the very highest regard for Henry Kissinger. And I thought Nixon was brilliant in terms of who he selected to do national security policy and how he dealt with international diplomatic relationships. He was a very difficult man to get to know on any kind of a personal basis.
Kind of cold man.
Because he was a very, I would say, a little aloof when you were around him. I can remember meetings with Henry Kissinger where I felt like I was in a graduate school classroom. Learning.
Yeah, if it hadn't been for Watergate, Nixon would have, that was what destroyed him. That one thing, because I think in many other ways he'd been a good president.
You know, surprising to people, and I was in the Labor Department where one probably, at least at first blush, would not think that the Nixon administration was terribly interested, and they were very interested. Yeah. They started Occupational Safety and Health. They were really the masterminds of all the manpower programs. They did a lot of work with moving people into safe and healthy jobs. I found it a fascinating place. Yeah.
Okay, 1971. Now, is that when you came back here?
No. I stayed in Washington for that year, then stayed on. I was asked to stay on through the 72 election. Usually White House fellows end in August or September.
Yeah.
I was asked to stay on because it was a transition year. So I stayed on through the election and was asked to stay then into the second administration, because by then they've actually hired me into the manpower programs, and I was working with a lot of administrative hearing issues, and I had actually a nice position. But I decided after the 72 elections I needed to get back and practice law. And I had an offer from a law firm in Washington, a very good law firm, where some of my friends were. And so I accepted a job at a Washington, D.C. law firm. And so I went there in January 72, well, right at the end of that year. During all this time, I had been dating John Taha, who was in Concordia, Kansas. And he and I had started dating after my first year in law school. He was the high school basketball coach and the math teacher in Concordia, Kansas. And all this time I'm doing this high-flying life. We have been sort of long-distance dating. He's saying, I love Kansas. I'm never leaving Kansas. My family's here, and I want to stay here. Me saying, I have this great life. I love it. I'm on the way up. If I come back to Kansas, I won't be able to do all these things. So this goes on for several years, but after I came back into law practice, reality sort of hit me. And though I loved the firm and loved the work, and I worked with some very big securities issues, ones that books have been written about, and worked with some great lawyers, I began to realize that I had to take care of my personal life, and that I wasn't really feeling like a whole person yet. And so John and I kind of went back and forth. Well, to make a very long story short, after I'd been there a year, sent John a telegram, a singing telegram when they used to do that, in his high school math class that said, yes, September 2nd. And so I came back, we got married, and it was right that year that I started commuting from Concordia. We lived in Concordia. I commuted down here and taught at the law school, and then taught with Del Brinkman a course in law of the press.
Concordia? That's
yeah.
A long ways from Lawrence.
Oh, it was forever. I drove 3 hours one way and 3 hours the other way.
How often?
Once a week. And taught a course in the law school and a course with Del Brinkman.
You did the law class with him, huh?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I did that one semester with him, too, the law seminar.
Oh, I loved it. It was fun.
Yeah.
We had many visitors. I think we had Whitley into that class, and we had Bob Wells in. So we had a great time. But anyway, then that spring, I got the chance, and by this time, I'm pregnant with our first child, I got the chance to come full-time on the law school faculty. And Martin Dickinson was dean, and to his eternal credit, invited me down to interview, and I did, and they appointed me to the full-time faculty that summer. But then it was a terribly wrenching time for John and me, because he was a coach, and you don't just change coaches. The year before, Lawrence High had changed coaches, and he was a finalist. In fact, I'm told one of the last two finalists for the Lawrence High job. But, you know, they picked somebody else. And they picked Ron Lang, who we've come to know and like. So then that year, the next year, when I'd accepted them, he had an offer to teach to coach at Turner High School in Kansas City. But at that time, the law hadn't changed, and they required coaches to live in the district. And John didn't want me having a brand new baby, driving back and forth, living in Kansas City. And so he came to Lawrence with no job. We had made an agreement when we got married that we would take turns making the big decisions, and we'd know them when they came. Turns out they've all been location. I left Washington, so I gave it up, what I thought was giving it up, and came back to Concordia, Kansas. Well, then when I get the chance to teach down here, my turn, And so he left what he was doing. Well, as luck, not luck, because in the end it was sad, but as luck would have it, Guy Keeler was running the Bureau of Lectures of Concert Artists, which, did you know Guy?
No, I don't think so.
Well, he was quite a guy. He had what was essentially the KU Lyceum programs for years and years. It had been part of continuing education. Then it went interstate, I think, started making a profit. Anyway, the university spun it off, and Guy ran it and owned it. Well, he hired John to work for him and eventually to manage the business. This was in August when we moved here with a brand new baby. I'm starting a new job. And so John starts this job, and in Thanksgiving weekend, Guy Keeler died. And so here is this business that Art Wolf, now do you know Art? Art Wolf was his son-in-law at the time. And so, of course, they inherited. And so that was a tough situation. But in any case, John ultimately bought the business. And so that's what he's been doing ever since. Then, of course, the next turn came when I was on up in administration and I got a chance to go up and be president of another major university, and it was John's turn, and I stayed in Lawrence.
What was your job description in the law school? I became pretty conscious of job descriptions when I was on the promotions committee with you.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I was hired to be, well, I was an associate professor, but I was hired to be the director of the legal aid program and to teach two courses in addition. Now, the legal aid program is the clinical legal education component. That time we were down up where we take low-income clients and do whatever work we can do for them with supervising attorneys.
You were still in the old building, weren't you?
Oh, yeah, we were, because that's another piece of my story, but when I was first hired, my office was over Owen's Flower Shop and over Joe's Bakery. That's where the legal aid clinic was. And so the student interns came down there, and we had some fabulous cases. And in some ways, doing legal aid work was the best experience of my whole legal career, because I learned what it was to sort of have a client come in off the streets, has terrible problems, personal, every kind of problem, and legal, and trying to help that person worked through the system was fabulous, because you couldn't only be a lawyer. You had to be a little bit of everything. And so I supervised student interns for, I think it was about 3 years, and taught property and administrative law, and I ended up teaching oil and gas quite a few times. Then in 1977, I became associate dean, and we were in Old Green, but it was the year that we were going to move.
How'd you get the associate dean?
Don't know that. Martin was dean.
Don't you ever look back on your career and and wonder, well, how did this happen to me, or why did this happen to me?
I've always liked administration. I've always liked working with people. I've always it's what makes this job actually ironic. I really liked it, and the law school faculty at the time was this fun, wonderful, cohesive faculty.
It was fine faculty.
It was really a great faculty. And but then I become associate dean, and I have to oversee this move to this new building. Uh-huh. A library, getting faculty offices, running. I ran a draft that made the NFL draft look like kid stuff for who got what faculty office. It was hilarious. They only had an hour to decide, and I went down the pecking order. But it worked. And there's still many of them in the same offices.
Yeah.
So then we moved into New Green. And then in 79, when Calgard left and Christofferson became vice chancellor, I applied then to be associate vice chancellor with Christofferson. And I figured a scientist could use a lawyer. And so I went up there, and then, of course, he didn't stay very long. And then I was picked to be vice chancellor. So that's sort of, and then I thought I'd be there for a while, and I thought, you know, the honest truth is I thought I'd be a president somewhere. But it turned out it was too hard to move. We had four kids in all levels of school. John had a business. And Gene Buttig was chancellor here. And then I get a call in, it would have been about April of 1985, from Bob Dole, suggesting he thinks that Kansas is going to get another circuit court position.
We'd only had one before, which was when Jim Logan was in. And he thought I ought to apply. I said, no way. Plus, there were other people who wanted it really bad. And some of them, they were my friends. And I said, no, I love my job. I'm too young. I'm not going to go do that when I'm 30, whatever, 8 years old. And I said, no, I'm not going to do that. I like my own job. I love the university. I'm not leaving. So this goes on for a couple months. And the two people, there were especially two people who were really my friends, who wanted this job really bad. And so I finally said to these people that were calling me, I said, you get me an absolute assurance that neither of my other friends is going to get it, that for some reason it's not going to happen, then I might put my name in. It wasn't 10 minutes before I got a call from a very high official saying, you would be a candidate and others aren't.
I want to talk with you a little bit about the vice chancellor job. As I listen to you, by the way, we've got a granddaughter who I think she's headed on the same kind of course in life that you've had.
Really? Oh, I'd love
we've
to
become,
visit her.
She gets very angry when we say this, that Laura will not be truly happy in life until she's president of the United States.
Well, I once thought I could do that.
Everything, well, she's of course in the honors program, and she was when she was in grade school, the principal would get her to be the person to direct visitors around the school and show them the school, and student council, but also every sports event that comes along. And
oh, good for
she
her.
tries for everything.
That's great. What's her name?
Laura. Oh yeah, she's a. Let me show you a picture.
Oh
of
yeah,
Laura.
Good.
I got. She's a lovely, little girl, and she's very. There's Laura, the basketball player.
Oh, is she darling? Oh.
Yeah, I told her. I said.
She is darling.
When the braces came off her teeth, I said, Laura, you're as beautiful as Julia Roberts.
I love it. Well, she does look a little like that.
She does.
She's
beautiful, isn't she?
Oh,
okay.
Great.
Well, you know, I knew you when you were. Of course, I first knew you when you were a student in one of my classes.
Yes.
But then, over in the vice chancellor's office. How many years were you there?
I was there from 19. Well, counting the year, I was there from 79 to 85. But I was vice chancellor from 81 to 85.
Okay, now were you there under Archie Dykes at all? Or?
I was. That was when I was an associate. When I was Christofferson's associate, Archie was still there, and I was hired. Actually, Gene Budig had just been hired as chancellor, and I remember him. And we were at the end of the search process for the vice chancellor, but they had waited for the new chancellor to pick the vice chancellor. And so I really think it was kind of, poor Gene was just stuck with me, because I think, as I remember this, the committee had made its recommendation. And then Gene came down and interviewed me, and I got hired.
Were there any people you ever didn't get along with there?
No. I mean, there were many people I had debates with, but you know, I can honestly say, I can't think of a person I didn't get along with. We had some very turbulent things.
Well, I want to ask you about one. Did you ever have any problems with Dale Scannell?
No.
Yeah.
No. Dale Scannell and I were friends. We had a couple of issues. I remember so clearly because he was such a proponent of the 5-year teacher education program. And it took a little convincing for me because it seemed kind of silly for us to go to a 5-year program where you didn't get a master's degree. And I was kind of a College of Liberal Arts and Sciences guy. And I thought that if they were going to expand that program, they ought to expand the Liberal Arts and Sciences requirement.
Well, I guess I would think that anyway. I think 4 years is ridiculous.
My position was that they should have expanded that. Now, they did to some extent. But Dale and I had our very strong moments over that. But I have to say about Dale Scannell that though he would be a very worthy adversary, He also understood sort of the organization of the university and sort of the interests of the university. And he and I were friends.
Yeah, he's one of my best friends. Did you ever work with Howard Mossberg?
Oh, I love Howard Mossberg. In fact, if I could say...
I was with him last night. Yeah.
If I could say I had sort of a senior advisor, Howard really was. I mean, he was such a good dean of pharmacy. He knew exactly how to work with sort of the entrepreneurial aspects of the university. He had an excellent sort of sense of timing about how to do that in that wonderful laid-back style. So, yes, I was lucky. I had great deans at the time. I had Dale Scannell. I had Jim Meeser. I had Howard Mossberg. Now, I did have some challenges in the college, it's still something I kind of agonize over because I selected Bob Lineberry, who was a great scholar and who was recommended by the committee and the whole thing. I think he had his rough times at KU, and I'm...
Yeah, he was not. He was not one of the successful names in the...
It was a troublesome time for me.
Well, I remember some of the hassles we had on that committee, especially over the matter of research.
Yeah.
And what constituted great research and so on. I was interested because 3 weeks ago I interviewed Dick Shaw, and Dick was one of the people who antagonized me most on that committee, but I had a great interview with him.
And, oh, he's a wonderful.
I understand his point of view to a certain extent, and the biggest pain for me, I'll be blunt about it, I don't care whether it's on the record or not, was Francis Horowitz. And it will remain that way in my thinking, I think, until I fall over.
Well, you know, now I have to say, Francis and I were very good friends, and many people don't really know that. She and I used to work late at night in Strong Hall, and I wish there were a picture of this, because I was down there on first floor and she was up on the second floor. And I at the time, took my shoes off all the time, and so we'd be batting around Strong Hall with nobody there, me barefoot. I'd go up and have a cup of tea with her, or she'd come down. We didn't agree on it. She is a, and I say this with all respect, she is a pristine scholar, in my view, was quite good for KU. She and I looked at things a little bit more through my professional school, and I guess it's probably more pragmatic eyes of a university administrator. But I thought she had some good values, and I liked her. I have felt bad because I think, you know, I think she was somewhat disappointed when I left in the surge. And so I've always felt bad about that. But.
Did you work with Heller much?
Oh, yes, and Francis Heller, again, there's another senior advisor.
He's one of the people I respect most.
Oh, he is fabulous. In fact, a great story on me is, you know, I've been vice chancellor of university, and all of a sudden I have to go get an interview at the Justice Department and the Senate Judiciary Committee over sort of what's going on in the legal world and in the Supreme Court. So before I went to Washington for all my interviews before I got this job, I called Francis and asked him if he would do me a giant favor. If he would sit down with me on a Saturday and for about 6 hours, just do me a big review of kind of where the issues are. And he did it, and it was wonderful. Oh, in fact, it's still my best preparation I had for this job.
I want to ask you something that is kind of personal. People told me I shouldn't ask questions.
Oh, I don't care.
What kind of a teacher do you think you were, and what kind of a vice chancellor do you think you were?
Oh, that's hard. And as judges always say, the person who writes the opinion knows least about what it says. I was never a scholar. I will readily admit that. I was never a scholar. I did some pretty good written work, but it wasn't what I think most good scholars would term, even in the law, would term good scholars. I think I was a pretty good teacher. I know I was a good legal aid teacher. I was a good on-the-streets lawyer working with students. In the classroom, I think I was up and down. When I first started, I was pretty good because I had lots of time for preparation and did a lot of work, and I think the students liked me, I mean, to the best of my knowledge, because I, for one thing, I was pretty near their age. For another, I think I had a fair amount of empathy. I never was one of those really, really cross Socratic method types. I will say, though, that I got all these administrative jobs, and as I went along, I felt like I wasn't being as good a teacher because I didn't have the time for the students. I didn't have the time for continued preparation, that kind of thing. And then I ultimately, I tried to keep teaching when I was vice chancellor, and I ultimately gave it up because it just got to be too much. And I kept on teaching Western Civ, I think, a couple of years. But, my evaluation would be mixed, how I was. And as I said, I'd be the last to know. As vice chancellor, you know, we always think we're pretty good. I thought I brought some strengths to that office. Among them were, I'm a pretty good listener. And I tried to hear what was being said. And there were some real cross currents in the university at the time. It was in Gene's early years, Gene Budig's early years. He was doing fine. But there was just, I mean, it's a big university. There was a lot to be done. I always thought we should move to the provost model long before we did. So I was delighted when Bob Hemingway did that, because there was always this sort of tension between the research side and the academic side that I thought was an artificial tension, and one that didn't allow for the kind of prioritizing and balancing that I thought ought to occur. But given the constraints of where I was, I would say, you know, when I was there, I had to cut $3 million out of the budget, out of the academic affairs budget. Now, that was no easy task, and you could have had enemies everywhere. I actually think I didn't end up with too many enemies, but I spent an enormous amount of time. I just held meetings, did all this stuff, trying to get everybody on the same page. I don't know what the deans would say about it. I had dean's retreats. I tried to listen as much as I could. I really honestly believe that a university administrator can have some vision and can take places, take universities to some places, but I most believe that they only can do that if they are very good and skillful listeners and negotiators.
You think you'll ever look back on your career and think of things that maybe you're kind of ashamed of that you wish hadn't happened?
Oh yes.
Did you ever do much compromising, do you think?
Yes, I've compromised. Although those wouldn't be the things I look back and feel sorry about, because when I've compromised, it hasn't been those things that I felt were.
It wasn't ever a compromise with your integrity.
No, no. Okay. I think I can say that with great comfort. The things I feel the worst about are interpersonal. There are a couple of relationships that just broke totally down.
Maybe it wasn't your fault.
Well, I don't know, but I take half the blame. So those I regret deeply, because no matter what I do in my whole life, it's those personal relationships that just make all the difference to me. And so I regret that. I don't regret decisions I've made. I've never looked back. I've never looked back on any decision. And that's gives you great comfort.
Now, what year did you become a judge?
I became, I went through all my hearings in 1985 and left the university on the 1st of January of 1986 and was sworn in January of 1986.
Yeah, well, I remember that when I gave that lecture of some kind, that you were the one who introduced me and so
That's
on.
Right,
now, that
yeah.
would have been, that was in the autumn of 85. So
probably that was very close to the end.
So you left right after that. When you took this job, how did your family feel about it?
Oh, they were glad. My youngest child was just a baby when I, because I was pregnant the time. I was vice chancellor.
You told me about the one. There are three others?
Yeah, there are four children. They range from 26 to 16 now. But at the time, of course, they were just little children. And one was a baby. And the university life, the administrator's life, was one that was so demanding on the nights and weekends. And I
can do a job and do it very thoroughly, but having to do so much social work at that time in my life. Now it wouldn't be near the problem, but at that time was taking me away from my husband and my family almost every night and every weekend. So they welcomed this, even though it meant much more traveling. When I'm in Lawrence, I just pick and choose what I'm going to do. And at that time, it did allow me a lot more flexibility. In the Vice Chancellor's office, you are scheduled from morning through the night. And it is very demanding, just as a personal matter. In fact, I worry terribly about my friend David Schulberger for exactly that reason.
Well, how often are you in Lawrence, or how much of the time?
Well, let me give you the standard answer here is our regular terms in Denver are 1 week out of every 2 months. So I would be required to be gone 1 week out of every 2 months. It has happened to me in the judiciary, as it has happened everywhere I've always been. I sort of got thrust into various administrative positions very rapidly. So when I first came on the bench, it wasn't a year before I was appointed to a committee and then as chair of a committee called the Committee on the Judicial Branch, which for the judiciary of the United States did a lot of our interaction with Congress. So I ended up being in Washington, being all over the country, doing that. Then, almost as soon as my term was finished there, I got appointed to the United States Sentencing Commission, which required 3 days a month in Washington again. Right this moment, I'm in a very nice one-year hiatus, which will end in January, in which I have no real administrative duties. But in January, I become Chief Judge of the Circuit. And so by the time January comes along, there will be a big celebration in Lawrence, and I will become Chief Judge of the Circuit. And that means I will be out and around the country a lot. I will be a member of the Judicial Conference of the United States, which is chaired by the Chief Justice, and it's the administrative arm of the judiciary of the United States.
How long do you intend to keep doing this?
Probably the rest of my life.
The rest of your life?
Yeah, probably. You know, the judiciary, we don't really retire. You can retire at 65, but most people stay on what's called senior status. So at 65, I will be allowed to go to senior status, which means you keep your part of your staff and your chambers, and you can reduce your workload down to a minimum of a fourth of a total workload. So as long as I am healthy and my mind's working okay, I'll probably keep doing this, in part because the judiciary needs the people strength so bad. And in part, I'm not sure I'll ever want to totally retire.
just not the type that would do anything like that. This is going to stop in a minute. I'm going to put another tape in, but don't think I'm going to make you talk through the whole thing. But I do want you to talk with me a bit about your experience as a judge.
Okay.
This has, of course, become a quite important thing in your life, I would guess.
Oh, yes.
One of the important things.
While you're doing that, I'm going to get some more coffee. You want anything else?
No, I'll tell you what I mean. Filled with the spectacular beauty of the northern wilds, the Dallas Morning News. Okay, you've been a judge.
Yeah.
What was your title?
I'm a United States Circuit Judge for the United States Court of Appeals for the Tenth Circuit.
Tenth Circuit. What kinds of cases have come up that you've had to deal with?
Well, to just sort of give a little federal court history here, we hear all cases that arise out of the states of Oklahoma, Wyoming, Colorado, Kansas, New Mexico, and Utah. The federal jurisdiction extends to everything that involves the statutes or Constitution of the United States. Controversies that involve the citizens of more than one state and $75,000 in controversy, those are the sort of two types of jurisdiction. Then, of course, we have habeas corpus jurisdiction over incarcerated people who assert constitutional deprivations. So we hear the whole gamut. The, for example, federal civil rights, federal securities, federal tax, all the federal environmental laws, and I might pause there for a moment because our circuit is very interesting because of the national parks and the national forests and the Indian reservations. Our circuit has an enormous proportion of federal lands, public lands. So we get, for example, we have sort of overseen, if you will, the reintroduction of the gray wolf in Yellowstone. We get lots of oil and gas and natural resource issues because of the public land.
Now, are there others who sit with you?
Yes, it's a court of authorized 12 judges. We sit in 3 judge panels. It is not like the courts that people see on television. These are courts of appeals where 3 judges hear the appeal. The appeal normally would not be of terribly great interest to the lay public because mostly by the time the issues get to us, they are rather complicated or technical, either statutory or constitutional or procedural issues. So I always like to say that when you came into my courtroom, you might be utterly bored. You only hear the lawyers. We rarely see the litigants. And it's very formal and very protocol written.
I remember I asked Paul Wilson once what he thought of L.A. law. And the damnedest nonsense. He said, I watched it for 10 minutes. I always thought it was kind of fun.
See, I have a hard time, as I told you earlier, I have a hard time watching court kinds of television programs and reading the novels. Now, some of...
John Grisham, haven't you read there?
I've read a few of them, and Scott Turow, actually.
Yeah,
he is a lawyer, and I actually got to know him this summer. And he writes very faithful accounts. Another one that has come out not too long ago is this thing called A Civil Action that ended up being a movie, too. That was actually a true story about a lawyer in a case. So once in a while, there's one comes along that I find to be quite good, but mostly I just can hardly stand to watch the manufactured stuff.
Well, much of the stuff from my few times I've been in a courtroom, I don't think that most things that take place in the courtroom are nearly as exciting and dramatic. They're certainly not the way Perry Mason.
Oh no! Oh no!
Yeah.
But you ask about the kinds of cases. I really love our circuit because of its diversity, both geographically and the people. For example, we have gotten a lot of very interesting First Amendment religious freedom and expression cases because there's quite a mix of kinds of religions. We have Utah, we have New Mexico, we have, and those have their very distinct religious cultures, as well as Oklahoma and Kansas. There have been a lot of tests of First Amendment issues. We've gotten a lot of free speech and press kinds of issues that have been very interesting. It's no secret, I just filed this year a big case which struck as unconstitutional some of the Campaign Finance Act with respect to contributions to parties. So the really fascinating thing about my job, though it is tons of reading, is that every time you pick up a case, you have to learn all about something totally new to you in many cases, and know enough about it to be able to make big decisions about it. And so, whether it's learning about the habitat, right now, very recently I've learned about the habitat of the Colorado lynx, which actually became the Alaskan lynx, and then they've reintroduced it back into Colorado. And in almost everything that happens these days, there are interest groups or litigants or somebody on all sides of things. We've had our share of abortion cases. We've had a lot of the big desegregation cases. The Brown case has stayed in our circuit for lo these many years. And we had Dow in Oklahoma City, and we had Denver Public Schools. So we've had a lot of desegregation cases. So I find the work intellectually just fascinating.
On our recent trip out west, we found ourselves, without knowing we were going to be there, in the Escalante National Monument.
Oh, yes.
And
I know that well.
Well, I would imagine. So we found it a magnificent place, and I frankly can't quite conceive of why, of what what or how or why that place should be torn up for oil wells or coal mining or whatever. There are a lot of things Clinton has done I didn't like, but that's one I really liked.
I think the general public really doesn't have a full understanding. Well, I know they don't have a full understanding of all of the converging issues over public lands and all of the interests at stake. And no matter what side you're on in it, there are some wonderful arguments to be made. And I have found that those cases among the most interesting, just the real competing interests. I was involved in a case which I ultimately did not prevail in the Supreme Court over grazing rights on the national lands. The conflicts, the more we get more and more crowded and more usages, then those conflicts become even more pronounced. And so I've loved those cases. We've had, the other thing, the much grimmer side of what we do, is that all of our states have the death penalty, and particularly Oklahoma has had an enormous number of executions in the last few years. And so, of course, our court is the last stop before the Supreme Court on all of those. And that's a very grim side and a very time-consuming.
I see that the Oklahoma City bomber is making a new appeal.
I noticed something about that in the paper. I don't know anything about
it. I don't know, yeah. Well, you see, I'm from the West originally, and something that always gets us when we're out there is talking with people. There's so many people in the West hate the federal government, but of course right now the people up in Montana want everything they can get from it because of those fires, you know. That's the way a lot of people are. They hate it until it
comes time to help out.
Well, this has been a good life for you.
Oh, yes. I've enjoyed it very much. I think part of why I like it is I've been able to stay in Lawrence, so I keep my university ties and contacts, and I keep saying I've got to quit doing as much. I chaired a search committee for him. I'm on another search committee for him. I'm chairing the Lead Center board this year. But I like that because it keeps my hand in what's going on at the university.
Who are your friends?
My personal friends or my
you and your husband?
Oh, well, we've had a group of friends for a long time that probably now should be described as middle-aged. We have had a group of friends largely that have revolved around John plays golf a lot.
Yeah.
And so they have been people like the Immels and the Catlins and the Olsons and the Berries and the Carters, and they're just a whole group of people that we've socialized with for 30 years.
Members, are you members of Albemarle?
No, we're members of Lawrence Country Club.
The Country Club.
We actually are members at Albemarle, but we live on Lawrence Country Club.
Did you actually retire from the university?
Did I retire? No, I think I resigned.
Well, but you see, you are listed as a retiree.
I am?
Well, yeah, that's one reason I'm interviewing you.
That's
you
hilarious.
Know,
I didn't know that.
Ray Nichols used to sit there and just seethe at the idea that Charlie Oldfather was a retiree. Well, he became a retiree by some action of the Board of Regents or something, because technically he just resigned from the university. But he then became a retiree. And Nichols was really mad at me when I interviewed Charlie. You know, why are you interviewing him? He's not a you know, Ray was that way. He could
oh,
get...
Oh, yeah,
he was a
dot the I's and cross the T's guy.
Oh, he could get quite explosive about people he didn't like. He hated Matty Crumrine because Matty Crumrine gave his son a B. And every time Matty Crumrine's name came up, Ray would sit there and just...
You didn't want to hear...
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's funny. I'm listed as a retiree. I had no idea. Never even knew that.
Well, of course, I go to those meetings. What is John Connor doing there? Or Glee Smith?
That's funny.
Well, they're members. I don't know how they, maybe some kind of special thing. No, you are. Maybe you ought to start going to some of the...
Well, I had no idea, but I'm glad I am.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Have you and your husband been able to travel much?
A little. We had a wonderful trip last year. We were invited by Justice Kennedy and Justice Thomas to represent the Courts of Appeals, and then with one Supreme Court Chief Justice of California, in this what's called the Anglo-American Legal Exchange. And so we went to England and Scotland and Wales last year with Justices Kennedy and Thomas and these other judges and then five lawyers, and met with our counterparts over there. That was just an incredible trip to sort of see the United Kingdom from the inside, if you will, and the courts. And of course we had all the pomp and circumstance. And then we had our 25th wedding anniversary a couple of years ago, and we went to Germany and Austria and the Czech Republic. John's family all came from the old Czechoslovakia. So we drove around and fooled around in that part of Europe and just had a great time.
Did you go up to Zugspitze?
No, didn't do that.
We did. That's the best thing we did on our journey.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, we'll have to remember that. We want to go back.
Oh, it's fabulous. What's the highest mountain in
I know where you're talking about.
In the German Alps.
Yeah. Well, we were down below. We went to Garmisch and we went to...
Oberammergau,
yeah. That's what I was trying to think.
Yeah, we stayed there a couple of nights. We're going to Norway next month.
Oh, have you been there?
We have been there once, but we didn't get into the fjords.
We're
going to take the coast trip.
That's what we did.
Clear
up. Go clear up to Trondheim.
Clear up and then back down. It's just a small ship.
The most beautiful thing.
We think we're going to like that. Right now we're wondering what kind of clothes we're going to take.
Well,
I think it's going to be cold.
Yeah, it'll be chilly. Now, when we did that, that was one of the nice benefits of being administrator. We got to go once in a while on those KU trips. And we took a KU trip to the fjords. And it was in June. It was on Midsummer's Night, I remember, because it was light all night. And it was still chilly up there. So I'll tell you, it'll be cold.
Do you know much about the University of Kansas these days? And what do you think about things? Do you have any judgments?
I stay very close to it. I try not to be involved in, you go to a dinner party and you hear some faculty railing about this or railing about that. I try to stay totally out of those. My sense of the university is that it's doing, I think KU is always going to do pretty well. If you look back over public funding for universities and compare states, KU has never gone up very much, but it's never gone down very much. It's been kind of a slow and steady incline. I still think the people of the state value having a great university, so that's worth a lot of money in the bank. And I think they want it to be a good place. I think there are still some fabulous faculty people up there. I worry about the new generation, if you will, the new generation of faculty. And again, I feel old saying this, but when I was vice chancellor and even when I came to the law school, there was a cadre, I'd say more than a cadre, a real phalanx, of faculty with enormous institutional loyalty, an enormous sense of Kansas and who we are and kind of why we're here, and real commitment to students, all those things. In my latter years as vice chancellor and more since I've been gone, I worry whether we have quite that institutional loyalty and quite that sense of the students as the, if you will, people that we're serving. I like Bob Heminley, and I think he has a real sense of that, and I have really liked his tours around Kansas and things like that are, some would say, window dressing. I would say they do more than just window dress. They sort of have a sense of connection with the place. To the extent that we continue to lose people, and I hate some of the losses that we've had in recent years, of who I would call the upper middle level faculty, then I think we've got to be careful to replace those people with really high-quality people.
You know what the university, how it was really hurt, in my opinion, when the World War II generation was gone.
Yeah.
Because I'm part of that. We were different.
Well, I think that's true throughout society.
I think it is.
I mean, the Greatest Generation means something.
And I don't like what I see of the kids these days. I don't like them. I do not like the School of Journalism.
Really? Now, I'm not close enough to know from day to day. I actually have stayed closer to the college and the law school, and my sense is both those places are doing pretty well. The law school had some terribly tough times.
Well, the School of Journalism might be doing all right, but I don't like the idea of, you know, I hear it, digital journalism. I say, there is no such thing as digital journalism. And I got a letter from Northwestern. Ken Bodie's leaving after 2 years as dean there, and they want suggestions I got my master's there. And I was tempted to recommend Jimmy Gentry, but I don't want to hurt Northwestern. I think they've been hurting up here. Dean Neal, I think it's almost time for us to close up. I know you've probably got other things you've got to do.
Oh, well, this has been kind of fun. You know, you don't often reflect back on all these things, so it's been kind of fun.
Are you glad that this was where you spent your life?
Yes. I love Lawrence. John and I both love Lawrence.
And the university.
And the university. And we feel so privileged to be in a town like this. Now, we say that when he is a veteran of the school wars, and I'm a veteran of a lot of the university issues, at least.
Yeah.
And both of us have been so involved in the community. And this is not an easy community to get things done in. But it gradually does the right thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've been watching the South Lawrence Trafficway issue, and I watched the American Eagle issue, and you know, you got to love a place where there's robust debate, and there is definitely robust debate here.
Yeah. Well, I thank you very much for talking with me today. I intrude myself too frequently into these things, but that's my style, and I don't really know what to do about
it. I've loved it.
I'm not going to change. I'm too damned old to change. And I've admired and liked you for a long time, and this has been a real pleasure to be with you today.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it too. I loved hearing about you, things I didn't know too. So it was mutually fun.